the frowning little forehead and the plump little hands with the bent fingers and palms that rubbed the tiny eyes and nose. At such moments especially, Karenin felt quite calm and at peace with himself, seeing nothing exceptional in his position and nothing that ought to be altered. But as time went on, he saw more and more clearly that, however natural his position might appear to him at the time, he would not be allowed to remain in it. He was conscious that, beside the good spiritual force which governed his soul, there existed a coarse power, as potent, if not more so, and that this power would not grant him the humble peace he desired. He felt that everybody looked at him with questioning surprise, without understanding him, expecting something from him. And especially he was aware of the insecurity and artificiality of his relation to his wife. When the softened mood caused by the nearness of death had passed, Karenin began to notice that Anna feared him, was oppressed by his presence, and avoided looking him straight in the eyes. It was as if she wished, yet could not make up her mind, to say something, and foreseeing that their present relation could not continue, expected something from him, too. At the end of February, Anna's newborn daughter, also named Anna, happened to fall ill. Karenin had been in the nursery that morning, and having given orders to send for the doctor, had gone to the department. Toward 4 o'clock, having finished his work, he returned home. On entering the anteroom, he saw there a handsome footman in gold-braided livery with a bearskin cape, holding a cloak lined with white fur.
"Who is here?" asked Karenin.
"Princess Elizabeth Fedorovna Tverskaya," answered the footman with a smile, as it seemed to Karenin.
All through that difficult time, Karenin noticed that all his worldly acquaintances, especially the women, displayed a particularly lively interest in him and his wife. He noticed in all these acquaintances a kind of joy which they suppressed with difficulty, like the joy he had noticed in the lawyer's eyes, and again, just now, in the footman's. Everybody seemed elated, as if they were giving someone in marriage. When they met him, they inquired, with scarcely hidden pleasure, about Anna's health. The presence of Princess Tverskaya and the memories associated with her, coupled with the fact that he had never liked her, was unpleasant to Karenin, and he went straight to the nursery. In the front nursery, Seretse, lying with his chest on the table and his legs on a chair, was drawing something and chattering merrily. An English nursery governess, who since Anna's illness had replaced the French governess with the boy, sat doing some crochet work. She hurriedly rose, curtsied, and nudged Seretse. Karenin passed his hand over his son's hair, answered the governess's inquiry about Anna's health, and asked what the doctor had said about baby. "The doctor says there is no danger and has ordered baths, sir."
"But she is still suffering," remarked Karenin, listening to the crying child in the next room.
"I think the nurse is unsuitable, sir," said the Englishwoman with decision.
"Why do you think so?" he asked, stopping short.
"The same thing happened in Countess Paul's case. The baby was medically treated, and then it turned out to be merely hungry and nothing more. The nurse has no milk, sir."
Karenin reflected a moment and then entered the other room. The little girl lay with her head thrown back, wriggling in the wet nurse's arms, and would neither take the breast nor cease screaming, despite the hushing of 2 nurses who were bending over her.
"Still no better?" asked Karenin.
"Very restless," said the head nurse in a whisper.
"Miss Edwards says that perhaps the nurse has no milk," he said.
"I think so too, Alexei Alexandrovich."
"Then why did you not say so?"
"Whom could I speak to? Anna Arkadyevna is still ill," said the old nurse in a dissatisfied tone.
The nurse was an old family servant, and in her simple words Karenin thought he noticed a hint at his position. The baby screamed louder, catching her breath and growing hoarse. The old nurse, with a gesture of vexation, came up and took her from the wet nurse and began pacing up and down, rocking the baby in her arms.
The doctor must be asked to examine the nurse, said Karenin. The healthy-looking wet nurse in her finery, evidently afraid of being dismissed, muttered something to herself as she covered her well-developed breast and smiled contemptuously at the idea of her not having sufficient milk. In that smile also, Karenin thought he saw himself and his position ridiculed.
Unfortunate child, said the nurse, hushing the baby and continuing to walk up and down with it.
Karenin sat down on a chair, and with a look full of suffering and weariness, watched the nurse as she paced the room. When the child was pacified and laid in her deep cot, and the nurse, after smoothing the little pillow, went away, Karenin rose, and stepping with difficulty on tiptoe, approached the infant. For a moment he stood silent, regarding the child with the same weary expression. But suddenly a smile, wrinkling the skin on his forehead and making his hair move, lit up his face, and he quietly left the room. He rang the bell in the dining room and told the servant to send for the doctor once more. He was vexed with his wife for not troubling about the charming baby, felt disinclined to go in and see her while in that frame of mind, and also disinclined to meet the Princess Betsy. But his wife might think it strange if he did not come in as usual, and so he mastered himself and went to her bedroom. Stepping on the soft carpet, as he approached the door, he involuntarily overheard a conversation which he had no wish to hear. If he had not been going away, I should understand your refusal, and his too. But your husband must be above that, Betsy was saying.
It is not for my husband's sake, but for my own, that I don't wish it. Don't talk about it, answered Anna in an excited voice.
Yes, but you can't but wish to say goodbye to a man who tried to shoot himself for your sake. It's just for that reason that I don't wish it.
Karenin, with a frightened and guilty face, stopped short and thought of returning unnoticed. But coming to the conclusion that this would be undignified, he turned, coughed, and went toward the bedroom door. The voices were silent, and he entered. Anna, in a grey dressing gown, with her black hair cropped short, but already growing again like a thick brush over her round head, sat on a couch. As usual, when she saw her husband, all her animation vanished from her face. She bowed her head and glanced uneasily at Betsy. Betsy, dressed in the very latest fashion, her hat soaring high above her head like a little chimney coronet over a lamp, in a dove-coloured dress with very pronounced diagonal stripes going one way on the bodice and the other way on the skirt, was sitting beside Anna, her flat, tall figure very erect and her head bent. She met Karenin with an ironical smile.
Ah, she exclaimed, as if in surprise. I'm so glad you're at home. I have not seen you since Anna's illness. I have heard everything, all about your attentiveness. Yes, you are a wonderful husband, she said, with a significant and affable expression, as if she were conferring on him an order of high-mindedness for his conduct toward his wife.
Karenin bowed coldly, and kissing his wife's hand, asked about her health.
I think I'm better, she said, avoiding his eyes.
But your face looks feverish, said he, emphasizing the word feverish.
We have been talking too much, said Betsy. I know it was selfish of me, and I am going.
She rose, but Anna, suddenly blushing, quickly seized her hand.
No, please stay. I must tell you. You, I mean. And she turned toward her husband, the colour spreading over her neck and forehead. I don't wish to hide anything from you.
Karenin cracked his fingers and bowed his head.
Betsy says Count Vronsky wanted to come and say goodbye before leaving for Tashkent.
She was not looking at her husband, and evidently was in a hurry to get through what she meant to say at any cost.
I said I could not receive him. You said, my love, that it would depend on Alexei Alexandrovich, Betsy corrected her. Oh, no, I can't receive him, and it would lead...
She stopped suddenly and glanced inquiringly at her husband, who was not looking at her.
In a word, I don't wish...
Karenin drew nearer and was going to take her hand. Her first impulse was to draw away her hand from his moist one with the thick swelling veins that was seeking hers, but with evident effort she pressed it.
I am very grateful for your confidence, but...
He began in confusion, feeling with vexation that what he could so clearly decide within himself he was unable to discuss in the presence of the Princess Tverskaya, who appeared to him the personification of that coarse power which would rule his life in the eye of the world, and which prevented him from yielding to his feelings of love and forgiveness. He stopped and looked at the princess.
"Well, goodbye, my precious,"
said Betsy, rising again. She kissed Anna and went out. Karenin followed her.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, I know you to be a really high-minded man,"
said Betsy, stopping short in the little sitting-room and once again pressing his hand with peculiar warmth.
"I am only an outsider, but I'm so fond of her and respect you so much that I will take the liberty of advising you. Receive him. Alexei Vronsky is honor personified. And besides, he is leaving for Tashkent."
"Thanks for your sympathy and advice, Princess. But the question whom my wife will and whom she will not receive, she will decide for herself." He said this from force of habit, with a dignified raising of his eyebrows, but immediately remembered that whatever he might say, there could be no question of dignity in his position, and saw the confirmation of this in the suppressed, cruel and ironical smile with which Betsy glanced at him when he had spoken. Chapter 20. Karenin took leave of Betsy when they reached the dining-room and returned to his wife. She was lying down, but on hearing his step she quickly sat up in her former place and glanced at him with apprehension. He saw that she had been crying.
"I am very grateful to you for your confidence," he repeated in Russian what he had said in French in Betsy's presence.
When speaking Russian to her he called her thou, and that always irritated her.
"And I am very grateful for your decision. I, too, think that, as he is going away, there is no need whatever for Count Vronsky to come here. However, but I have already said so. Then why repeat it?"
Anna suddenly interrupted him, with an irritation she could not repress.
No need whatever, she thought, for a man to come and take leave of a woman he loves, for whose sake he wanted to die and has ruined himself, a woman who cannot live without him? No need whatever.
And she pressed her lips together and lowered her glistening eyes, looking at his hands with their swollen veins, which he was slowly rubbing together.
"Let us say no more about it," she added more calmly.
"I left it to you to decide the matter, and am very glad to see," began Karenin,
"that my wish coincides with yours."
She rapidly completed his sentence, exasperated by the slowness with which he spoke, and knowing beforehand what he would say. He assented.
"Yes, and Princess Tverskaya's intrusion into this most difficult family matter is entirely out of place, especially as she—"
"I don't believe anything they say about her," Anna put in quickly.
"I know that she is sincerely fond of me."
Karenin sighed and paused. She was agitatedly toying with the tassels of her dressing gown, glancing at him with that tormenting feeling of physical repulsion for which she blamed herself, but which she could not overcome. The one thing she was longing for was to get rid of his obnoxious presence.
"I have just sent for the doctor," said he.
"I am quite well. Why should I need the doctor?"
"Yes, but the little one keeps screaming, and they say the nurse has not enough milk."
"Then why would you not let me nurse her when I entreated you to?
She is a child, anyhow. He understood what she meant by that, anyhow. And they will kill her. She rang and ordered the baby to be brought. I asked to be allowed to nurse her, and I wasn't. And now I am blamed.
I don't blame...
Yes, you are blaming me. Oh, God, why did I not die? And she began to sob.
Forgive me. I am upset. I am unjust.
She went on, controlling herself. But go.
No, it can't go on like that, he told himself with conviction after leaving his wife. Never before had his impossible situation, as the world thought it, his wife's hatred and the strength of that coarse power, which, in direct opposition to his inward mood, dominated his life and demanded fulfillment of its decrees and a change in his relation to his wife, never before had the impossibility of his position appeared so evident. He saw clearly that the world and also his wife were demanding something from him, but exactly what this something was he did not comprehend. All this was arousing a feeling of animosity in his soul, spoiling his peace of mind and depriving his achievement of all value. He considered it better for Anna to break off her relations with Vronsky. But if everyone thought this impossible, he was even ready to allow those relations to be renewed, so long as no slur was thereby cast on the children. He was not deprived of them, and his position was not altered. Bad as this would be, it would be preferable to a complete rupture which would place her in a hopeless and shameful position and deprive him of all he loved. But he felt powerless. He was aware in advance that everybody would be against him, and that he would not be allowed to do what now seemed so natural and good, that he would be obliged to do what was wrong, but what seemed to them necessary.
Chapter 21. Before Betsy had passed out of the dining room, Oblonsky, who had just come from Elisaev's, where newly arrived oysters were to be had, met her in the doorway.
"Ah, Princess, what a pleasure to meet you," he began, "and I have been at your house."
"We meet only for a moment, as I am just going," said Betsy, smiling and putting on her glove.
"Wait a little, Princess, before putting on your glove. Let me kiss your hand. There is nothing for which I am more thankful than for the revival of the old custom of hand-kissing."
And he kissed Betsy's hand.
"When shall I see you again?"
"You are not worth it," said Betsy, smiling.
"Yes, I am well worth it, because I have become the most serious of men. I not only settle my own, but other people's family affairs," said he, with a significant glance.
"Oh, I am very glad," said Betsy, at once understanding that he referred to Anna. She returned to the dining room with him, and they stood together in a corner.
"He will kill her," said Betsy in a significant whisper. "This is impossible. Impossible."
"I'm very glad you think so,"
returned Oblonsky, shaking his head with an expression of grave, woebegone commiseration.
"That is why I have come to Petersburg."
"The whole town is talking of it," she said. "It is an impossible situation. She is fading away, fading away." "He does not understand that she is one of those women who cannot play with their feelings. One of two things must happen. Either he must take her away, acting energetically, or he must divorce her. But all this is stifling her."
"Yes, yes, exactly," said Oblonsky, sighing. "I have come because of that. I mean, not entirely because of it. I have been made chamberlain and had to tender my thanks. But the chief thing is to get this affair settled."
"Well, then, may God help you," said Betsy. Having seen her down to the hall and again kissed her hand, a little above the glove, just where the pulse beat, and having told her some rubbish so daring that she did not know whether to be angry or to laugh, Oblonsky went to his sister's room. He found her in tears. Though he was overflowing with high spirits, Oblonsky immediately fell into a sympathetic and romantic mood suited to hers, inquired after her health, and asked how she had spent the morning.
"Very, very badly. This afternoon, and morning, and all other days, past and future," she replied.
"I think you give way to melancholy. You should rouse yourself and look life straight in the face. I know it is hard, but..."
"I have heard it said that women love men for their very faults," Anna began suddenly.
"But I hate him for his virtues. I cannot live with him.
Try and realize it. Even his looks have a physical effect on me and drive me beside myself. I cannot live with him.
What am I to do?
I was unhappy and thought it impossible to be more so. But I could never have imagined such a terrible position as I am now in. Will you believe it? Knowing that he is a kind and generous man, that I am not worth his little finger, nevertheless, I hate him. I hate him for his generosity. There is nothing left for me but..."
She was going to say death, but he did not let her finish.
"You are ill and excited," said he. "Believe me, you're greatly exaggerating the case. There is nothing so very terrible about it."
Oblonsky smiled. No one else in his place, having to deal with such despair, would have permitted himself to smile, for a smile would have appeared callous. But in his smile there was so much kindness and almost feminine tenderness that it was not offensive, but soothing and pacifying. His soft, comforting words and smiles had as soothing and calming an effect as almond oil, and Anna soon felt this.
"No, Stiva," said she, "I am lost. Quite lost. And even worse than lost. I am not lost yet. I cannot say all is finished. On the contrary, I feel that all is not yet finished. I'm like a tightly strung cord which must break. But all is not finished. And it will end in some dreadful manner."
"Oh, no, one can loosen the string, gently. There is no situation from which there is no escape."
"I've been thinking and thinking."
"Only one?"
Again he understood from her frightened face that she considered death to be the only escape, and did not let her finish.
"Not at all," he replied. "Listen. You can't see your position as I can. Let me tell you my frank opinion."
Again he smiled, his almond oil smile.
"I will begin at the beginning. You married a man 20 years older than yourself. You married without love and without having known love. That was a mistake, I grant."
"A dreadful mistake," said Anna.
"But again I say that is an accomplished fact. Next, let us admit that you had the misfortune to fall in love, not with your husband. That is a misfortune, but that too is an accomplished fact. Your husband has accepted that and forgiven you."
He paused between each sentence, expecting her to make objections, but she made no answer.
"That is so. Now comes the question. Can you go on living with your husband? Do you wish it? Does he wish it?"
"I don't know at all."
"But you yourself say you cannot endure him."
"No, I did not say so. I take back those words. I know nothing. I understand nothing." "Yes, but let me..." "You can't understand.
I feel that I'm flying headlong over some precipice, but must not even try to save myself. And I can't."
"Never mind. We'll spread out something to catch you."
"I understand that you cannot take it upon yourself to express your wishes and feelings."
"I have no wishes at all. Except that everything were at an end."
and he sees that and knows it.
Do you think it weighs on him less than on you? You suffer, and he suffers. What can come of that?
Well, a divorce would solve the whole problem, said Oblonsky, not without difficulty expressing his main idea and looking at her significantly. She replied only by shaking her cropped head, but by the expression of her face, suddenly illuminated with its old beauty, he saw that the only reason she did not wish for this solution was because it seemed to her an impossible happiness.
I am dreadfully sorry for you both.
How happy I should be if I could arrange it,
continued Oblonsky, now smiling more boldly.
Don't say a word.
If only God helps me to say what I feel. I shall go to him.
Anna looked at him with dreamy, shining eyes, but said nothing.
Chapter 22. Oblonsky, with the same rather solemn expression with which he was wont to take the chair at council meetings, entered Karenin's study. Karenin, with his arms crossed behind him, was pacing up and down, meditating on the very subject that his wife and Oblonsky had been discussing.
"I'm not disturbing you," asked Oblonsky, experiencing at the sight of his brother-in-law a feeling of embarrassment quite unusual with him.
To hide that embarrassment, he took out a cigarette case with a new kind of fastening, which he had only just bought, smelt the leather of which it was made, and took out a cigarette.
"No. Do you want anything?" Karenin answered reluctantly.
"Yes.
I must have a talk with you," said Oblonsky, surprised at his own unaccustomed timidity.
That timidity was so unexpected and strange that Oblonsky could not believe it was his conscience telling him that what he was about to do was wrong. He made an effort and conquered it.
"I hope you believe in my affection for my sister and my sincere attachment and respect for yourself," said he, flushing.
Karenin stopped. He made no reply, but the expression of submissive self-sacrifice on his face struck Oblonsky.
"I intended to talk to you about my sister and your mutual position," said Oblonsky, still struggling with his unwonted timidity.
Karenin smiled sadly, looked at his brother-in-law, and without replying went to the table and took from it an unfinished letter which he handed to him.
"I think about that subject incessantly, and this is what I have begun to write, as I think I can put it better in writing, and my presence is distasteful to her," he said, holding out the letter.
Oblonsky took the letter, looked with perplexed amazement at the dull eyes fixed on him, and began reading. "I see that my presence is distasteful to you. Hard as it was for me to assure myself of this, I see that it is so, and there is no help for it. I do not blame you, and God is my witness that when I saw you ill, I resolved with my whole soul to forget everything that had come between us and to begin a new life. I do not repent, and never shall repent of what I did, as my only desire was for your welfare, the welfare of your soul. But now I see that I have not succeeded. Tell me yourself what would give you real happiness and peace of mind. I submit myself entirely to your wishes and sense of justice."
Oblonsky returned the letter and went on looking at his brother-in-law with the same amazement, not knowing what to say. That silence was so disconcerting to both that Oblonsky's lips twitched painfully as he silently and fixedly gazed at Karenin's face.
"That is what I wanted to tell her," said Karenin as he turned away.
"Yes, yes,"
said Oblonsky, tears choking him and preventing his reply.
"Yes. Yes, I understand you,"
he brought out at last.
"I must know what she wants,"
said Karenin.
I am afraid she does not understand her position herself. She is no judge of it, replied Oblonsky, growing more composed. She is crushed, literally crushed, by your generosity. If she reads this letter, she will not have the strength to say anything. She will only hang her head lower than ever.
Yes, but under these circumstances, how is an explanation to be arrived at?
How am I to find out what she wishes? If you will permit me to express my opinion, I think it is for you to say what you think should be done in order to put an end to this state of affairs.
Then you think that an end should be put to it? Karenin interrupted him. But how? He added, moving his hands before his eyes in a manner unusual with him. I don't see any possible way out.
There is a way out of every situation, said Oblonsky, rising and growing excited. There was a time when you wished to break with her. Should you be now convinced that you cannot make each other mutually happy?
Happiness can be defined so differently. However, I am ready to agree to anything.
I want nothing at all.
What way out is there in our case?
If you wish to know my opinion, said Oblonsky, with the same soothing, almondy tender smile with which he had addressed Anna, a kindly smile so convincing that Karenin, conscious of his own weakness and yielding to it, was involuntarily ready to believe anything Oblonsky should say. She would never say so, but there is one way out, one thing she might wish. It would be to terminate your relations and everything that reminds her of them. As I look at it, in your case it is necessary to clear up your newly arisen relation to one another, and this new relation can only be established when both are free.
Divorce, Karenin interrupted with disgust.
Yes, divorce, I think. Yes, divorce, Oblonsky answered, reddening. That would be the most reasonable way from every point of view with a couple placed as you are. What is to be done if they find out that life together has become impossible, as might happen anywhere?
Karenin sighed heavily and closed his eyes.
There is only one thing to consider. Does either party wish to remarry? If not, it is very simple, went on Oblonsky, gradually overcoming his embarrassment.
Karenin, his face drawn with distress, muttered something to himself and made no reply. He had considered a thousand times all this which appeared so simple to Oblonsky, and it seemed to him not only far from simple, but altogether impossible. An action for divorce, with the details of which he was now acquainted, seemed impossible, because a feeling of self-respect and his regard for religion would not allow him to plead guilty to a fictitious act of adultery, and still less to allow the wife he had forgiven and whom he loved to be indicted and disgraced. For other and yet more important reasons also, divorce seemed out of the question. In case of a divorce, what would become of his son? To leave him with his mother was not possible. The divorced mother would have another, an illegitimate family, in which the position and education of a stepson would, in all probability, be a bad one. Should he keep him himself? He knew that would be revengeful, and he did not wish for revenge. But besides all this, what made divorce seem to Karenin more impossible than any other cause was that by consenting to it, he would, by that very act, ruin Anna. What Dolly had said in Moscow to the effect that in considering a divorce he was thinking of himself and not of Anna, who would then be irretrievably lost, had sunk into his heart. And having connected these words with his forgiveness and with his attachment to the children, he now understood them in his own way. To agree to a divorce, to give her her freedom, would mean, as he looked at it, to deprive himself of the only thing that bound him to life, the children he loved, and to deprive her of the last support on the path of virtue, and cast her to perdition. As a divorced wife, she would form a union with Vronsky which would be both illegal and criminal, because, according to the law of the Church, a wife may not remarry as long as her husband is living. She will form a union with him, and within a year or two he will either abandon her, or she will unite with someone else,
thought Karenin.
And I, by consenting to an illegal divorce, shall be the cause of her ruin. Hundreds of times he had thought it over, and had come to the conclusion that a divorce was not merely less simple than his brother-in-law considered it, but quite out of the question. He did not believe a word of what Oblonsky was saying, and for all his arguments had scores of refutations ready. Yet he listened, feeling that those words expressed that coarse and mighty power which overruled his life and to which he would have to submit. "The only question is, on what conditions you will agree to a divorce? Oh, she does not want anything, does not ask for anything, but leaves all to your generosity."
Oh, God, how have I deserved this, thought Karenin,
recalling the particulars of a divorce suit in which the husband took all the blame on himself, and with the same ashamed gesture with which Vronsky had covered his face, he hid his own in his hands.
"You are upset. I quite understand. But if you consider,
whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also," thought Karenin.
"Yes, yes," he cried in a shrill voice. "I will take the disgrace, and even give up my son. But, had we not better let it alone? However, do as you like."
And turning away so that his brother-in-law should not see his face, he sat down on a chair by the window. It was very bitter, and he felt ashamed. Yet mixed with the bitterness and the shame, he felt a sense of joy and emotion at the greatness of his own humility. Oblonsky was touched. He remained silent for a while.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, believe me, she will esteem your generosity," said he. "But evidently it was God's will," he added, and having said it, felt how silly it was, and could hardly help smiling at his own stupidity.
Karenin would have answered, but could not for his tears.
"It is a fatal disaster, and has to be faced. I regard this disaster as an accomplished fact, and am trying to help both you and her," Oblonsky went on.
When he left his brother-in-law's room, Oblonsky was touched, but this feeling did not spoil his contentment at having successfully arranged the matter, for he was certain that Alexei Alexandrovich would not go back on his word. To his contentment was added an idea that had just occurred to him. When the affair was all settled, he would ask his wife and intimate friends a riddle. "What is the difference between me and a chemist?" Answer: "A chemist makes solutions which do not make anyone happy, but I have made a dissolution and made three people happy." Or, "Why am I like a chemist? When, however, I will improve on it later," he said to himself, with a smile.
Chapter 23.
Although Vronsky's wound had missed the heart, it was dangerous, and for several days he lay between life and death. When he was first able to talk again, his brother's wife, Varya, was alone with him.
"Varya," he said, looking sternly at her, "it went off accidentally. Never speak of it, please, and tell everybody else that, or else it would be too stupid."
Without saying a word, Varya bent over him and looked in his face with a joyful smile. His eyes were clear and no longer feverish, but their expression was stern.
"Well, thank God," she exclaimed.
"You are not in pain?"
"A little, here," and he pointed to his chest.
"Then let me change the bandage." He looked at her silently, his broad jaws set, while she bandaged him. When she had finished, he said, I am not delirious. Please arrange so that no one shall say that I shot myself on purpose.
But no one does say so. Only I hope you will not go letting it off accidentally any more, said she with an inquiring smile.
I expect I shan't, but it would have been better. And he smiled gloomily. Despite these words and that smile, which greatly perturbed Varya, when the inflammation left him and he became convalescent, he felt that he had rid himself entirely of one part of his grief. By his action, he seemed to have washed off the shame and degradation he had previously felt. Now he could think quietly about Karenin, fully realizing his generosity without being humiliated thereby. Besides that, he got into his old rut again. He found he could look people in the face once more, and he was able to live in accord with his former habits. The one thing he could not tear out of his heart, although he continually struggled against it, was a regret bordering on despair at having lost Anna forever. That now, having atoned for his guilt toward her husband, he would be obliged to give her up and never place himself between her with her remorse and her husband, was clear to his mind. But he could not eradicate from his heart a regret for the loss of her love, could not efface from his memory the moments of happiness he had known with her, moments he had valued so lightly, but the image of which, with all their charm, pursued him still. Serpukhovskoy thought out a post for him in Tashkent, and Vronsky accepted the proposition without the least hesitation. But the nearer the hour for his departure approached, the harder seemed the sacrifice he was making to what he considered his duty. His wound was quite healed, and he went about making preparations for his journey to Tashkent.
Only to see her once more, and then to bury myself, to die, he thought, as he was making a round of farewell calls, and he expressed this thought to Betsy.
It was with this message that Betsy went to Anna, and she brought him an answer in the negative.
So much the better, thought Vronsky when he heard it. It would have been a weakness, would have taken away all the strength I have left.
Next day, Betsy herself came and announced that she had received, through Oblonsky, the definite news that Karenin consented to a divorce, and that therefore Vronsky might see Anna. Without so much as taking the trouble of seeing Betsy to the door, or of asking when he could see Anna and where her husband was, Vronsky, in spite of all his resolutions, at once went to the Karenins. Without seeing anyone or anything, he ran up the stairs and entered her room with hurried steps, almost at a run. Without thinking or considering whether they were alone or not, he embraced her and covered her face, hands, and neck with kisses. Anna had prepared herself for this meeting and had thought about what she would say to him, but she had no time to say any of it, seized by his passion. She wished to calm him and herself, but it was too late. His passion communicated itself to her. Her lip trembled so that for a long time she could not speak.
Yes, you have taken possession of me, and I am yours,
she brought out at last, pressing his hands to her bosom.
It had to be, said he. As long as we live, it will have to be. Now I am sure of it.
It is true,
she said, growing paler and paler, putting her arms about his head.
Still, there is something terrible in this after what has been.
It will pass. It will all pass, and we shall be so happy. If our love could be stronger, there being something terrible in it would make it so, he said, raising his head with a smile that showed his fine teeth.
She could not help smiling in answer, not to his words, but to his enamored eyes. She took his hand and stroked with it her cold cheek and cropped hair.
I don't know you with this short hair.
You have improved so, you little boy. But how pale you are. Yes,
You're very weak, she said with a smile, and her lip trembled again.
We shall go to Italy, and you will soon get well, said he.
Is it possible that we shall be like husband and wife, alone, a family? You and I, she said, looking closely into his eyes.
I am only surprised that it could ever have been otherwise.
Steva says he will agree to anything, but I cannot accept his generosity, she said, dreamily, gazing past Vronsky's face. I don't want a divorce. Nothing matters to me now. Only I don't know what to decide about Siretsa.
He was quite unable to understand how she could, at the moment of their first reunion, think about her son and divorce, as if all that were not immaterial. Don't talk and don't think about it, he said, playing with her hand and trying to draw her attention to himself. But she continued to gaze past him.
Oh, why did I not die? It would have been best,
she said, the tears streaming noiselessly down her cheeks. But unwilling to pain him, she tried to smile. To refuse the flattering offer of a post at Tashkent, which was a dangerous one, would have seemed disgraceful and impossible according to Vronsky's former views. But now, without a moment's hesitation, he did refuse it, and, observing that his superiors frowned upon his action, at once resigned his commission. A month later, Karenin and his son were left alone in the house, and Anna went abroad with Vronsky. Not only without getting a divorce, but having resolutely refused it.
Part 5, Chapter 1. The Princess Shcherbatskaya at first considered it out of the question to have the wedding before Advent, to which there remained but 5 weeks, but could not help agreeing with Lievin that to put it off until after the fast might involve waiting too long, for Prince Shcherbatsky's old aunt was very ill and likely to die soon, and then the family would be in mourning and the wedding would have to be considerably deferred. Consequently, having decided to divide her daughter's trousseau into 2 parts, a lesser and a larger, the princess eventually consented to have the wedding before Advent. She decided that she would have the smaller part of the trousseau got ready at once and would send on the larger part later, and she was very cross with Lievin because he could not give her a serious answer to her question whether he agreed with this arrangement or not. This plan would be all the more convenient because the young couple intended immediately after the wedding to go to the country, where the larger part of the trousseau would not be required. Lievin continued in the same condition of delirium as before, imagining that he and his joy were the chief or only purpose of all existence, and that he need not now think or bother about anything, as other people would see to everything for him. He had not even any plans or aims for the future, but left these to others to decide, quite sure that everything would turn out splendidly. His brother, Sergei Ivanich, Oblonsky, and the princess directed his actions. He quite agreed to every proposal. His brother borrowed money for him. The princess advised him to return to the country after the wedding, and Oblonsky suggested going abroad. He agreed to everything.
Do whatever you like, whatever pleases you. I am happy, and my happiness cannot be made or marred by anything you do, he thought.
When he told Kitty of Oblonsky's advice that they should go abroad, he was quite surprised at her opposition to it, and to find that she had definite ideas of her own about their future life. She knew that in the country Lievin had work of which he was fond. As he saw, she not only did not understand that work, but did not wish to understand it. This, however, did not prevent her considering it very important, and besides, she knew their home would be in the country, and she wanted to go, not abroad, where they were not going to live, but to where her home would be. This decided expression of her wish surprised Lievin, But, as it was quite immaterial to him, he at once begged Oblonsky to go to the house in the country, just as if it were Oblonsky's duty to go, and arrange everything there according to his own good taste. "I say," Oblonsky asked Levin one day after his return from the country, where he had made all preparations for the young couple, "have you got a certificate to show that you have received communion?" "No. Why?" "Well, they won't marry you without it." "Oh, dear," exclaimed Levin. "I think it is 9 years since I went to communion. I haven't thought about it."
"You are a good one," remarked Oblonsky, laughing. "And you call me a nihilist. But it won't do, you know. You must confess and receive the sacrament."
"When? There are only 4 days left." But Oblonsky arranged that, too. Levin began to prepare himself. To him, as an agnostic who yet respected the religious beliefs of others, it was always very trying to be present at or to take part in any religious ceremony. In his present state of mind, softened and sensitive to everything, to be obliged to pretend was not only trying, but appeared impossible. Now, in his state of triumph at the flowering time of his life, he was to be obliged to lie or blaspheme. He felt unable to do either. But question Oblonsky as he would, as to whether he could not obtain a certificate without going to communion, Oblonsky declared that he must go through with it.
"Besides, what does it amount to? 2 days! And the priest is such a nice old man. He will draw that tooth for you so that you will scarcely feel it."
Standing in church during the first service he attended, Levin tried to revive the memories of his youth and the strong religious feeling with which at the age of 16 or 17 he had been imbued. But he immediately became convinced that it was out of his power to do so. He then tried to regard it all as a meaningless, empty custom, like making a round of calls, but felt equally unable to do that. In matters of religion, Levin, like most of his contemporaries, had very indefinite views. He could not believe in it, and yet was not firmly convinced that it was all false. Therefore, unable either to believe in the importance of what he was doing or to look upon it with indifference as an empty form, he, while preparing for confession, felt awkward and ashamed at doing something incomprehensible, and therefore, as an inner voice told him, necessarily false and wrong. During the service, he would sometimes listen to the prayers, trying to see in them a meaning which would not clash with his opinions, or, finding that he could not understand and had to disapprove of them, he would try not to listen, but to occupy his mind with observation of what was going on, or with recollections which passed with extraordinary clearness through his brain as he stood idly in the church. He stood through the Mass and Vespers and Evensong, and the next day, having got up earlier than usual, he went to church before breakfast to hear morning prayers and to confess. No one else was in the church except a soldier beggar, 2 old women, and the clergy. The young deacon, the 2 halves of his long back clearly distinguishable through his thin undercassock, met him, and going at once to a small table beside the wall, began reading the prayers. While he was reading, and especially during the frequent and rapid repetitions of "Lord, have mercy upon us," which sounded like "Lord, mercy upon us," Levin felt as if his mind were closed and sealed up, and that, if he did make it stir now, nothing but confusion would result. Therefore, as he stood behind the deacon, he continued his own train of thought without listening or trying to comprehend what was being read. "How wonderfully expressive her hand is," he thought, recalling how they had sat at the corner table the day before. As was nearly always the case just then, they had nothing to say to each other, and she had put her hand on the table and kept opening and closing it until she herself began to laugh at its motions. He remembered how he had kissed the hand and afterwards examined the converging lines on the rosy palm. "Again, Lord of Mercy Ponce," thought he, crossing himself, bowing and watching the movements of the bowing deacon's flexible back. "Then she took my hand and examined the lines and said, 'You have a splendid hand.'" And he glanced at the deacon's stumpy hand and at his own. "Well, it'll soon be over now," he thought. "No, I believe it is all going to begin again. and he listened to the prayer.
Yes, it is coming to an end. There he is, bowing down to the ground.
That always happens just before the end. Having stealthily received a 3-ruble note into his hand, under its velvet cuff, the deacon said he would put down Lievin's name, and went briskly into the chancel, his new boots clattering over the paved floor of the empty church. A minute later he put his head out and beckoned to Lievin. The sealed-up thoughts began stirring in Lievin's head, but he hastened to drive them away.
"It will get settled somehow," he thought, and went to the ambeau. On going up the steps and turning to the right, he saw the priest. The latter, an old man with a thin, grizzled beard and kind, weary eyes, stood beside the lectern, turning over the leaves of a missal. Bowing slightly to Lievin, he began at once in his stereotyped tone to read the prayers. At the end he bowed to the ground and turned to Lievin.
"Christ, though unseen, is here present to receive your confession," he said, pointing to a crucifix. "Do you believe in the teachings of the Holy Apostolic Church?" continued the priest, turning his eyes away and folding his hands beneath his stole.
"I have doubted and still doubt everything," replied Lievin in a voice unpleasant to himself, and stopped. The priest paused a few seconds to see whether Lievin would say anything more, and then, closing his eyes, said rapidly with a strong provincial accent, "Doubts are natural to human weakness, but we must pray that our merciful Lord will strengthen us. What are your particular sins?" he continued, without the slightest pause, as if anxious not to waste time.
"My chief sin is doubt. I doubt everything, and am in doubt nearly all the time." "Doubt is natural to human weakness," repeated the priest. "What do you doubt in particular?"
"Everything. Sometimes I even doubt the existence of God," said Lievin involuntarily, and was horrified at the impropriety of his words, but they seemed to have no effect on the priest.
"What doubt can there be of the existence of God?" he asked with a faint smile.
Lievin was silent.
"What doubt can you have of the Creator when you see his creation?" continued the priest in his rapid, stereotyped voice. "Who has adorned the vault of heaven with luminaries? Who has decked the earth with beauty? How could it all be without a Creator?" he asked with an inquiring glance at Lievin.
Lievin felt that it would not be proper to enter into a philosophic discussion with a priest, and therefore merely replied to the direct questions, "I don't know."
"You don't know?
Then how can you doubt that God created everything?" said the priest in puzzled amazement.
"I don't understand it at all," said Lievin, blushing and feeling that his words were silly and that they could not but be silly. "Pray to God and entreat him. Even the Holy Fathers doubted and prayed God to strengthen their faith. The devil is very powerful, and we must resist him. Pray to God," he repeated hurriedly.
The priest paused a while as if in thought.
"I hear you are about to enter into holy matrimony with the daughter of my parishioner and spiritual son, Prince Shcherbatsky," he added with a smile. "A splendid young woman."
"Yes," answered Lievin, with a blush for the priest.
"Why need he ask me that at confession?" he thought. And as if in answer to the thought, the priest said,
"You are about to enter into matrimony, and God may give you children, is it not so? Then what sort of education can you give your little ones if you do not conquer in yourself the temptations of the devil who is leading you into unbelief?" he asked in mild rebuke. "If you love your offspring, then you, as a kind father, will desire not only riches, luxury, and honors for your child, but will desire his salvation, his spiritual advancement by the light of truth. Is that not so? And when your innocent little one asks, 'Papa, who has created everything that pleases me in this world? Earth, water, sun, flowers, grass,' what will you say? Will you really say to him, 'I don't know'?
Well, you cannot help knowing, since God, in his great mercy, has revealed it to you. Or, your child may ask you, what awaits me beyond the tomb? What will you tell him if you yourself know nothing? How will you answer him? Will you leave him to the temptations of the world and the devil? That is wrong.
The priest ceased, and with his head on one side, regarded Lievin with mild, kindly eyes. This time Lievin did not reply, not because he did not wish to enter upon a discussion with the priest, but because no one had ever yet put such questions to him, and also because, before his little one could begin asking such questions, there would be plenty of time to consider what the answers should be.
"You are entering upon a time of life," the priest went on, "when you must choose your path and keep to it. So pray that God in his goodness may help you and have mercy on you," he concluded. "May the Lord our God Jesus Christ, in the goodness and bounty of his love for mankind, pardon thee." And having pronounced the absolution, the priest blessed him and let him go. When he got home that day, Lievin felt relieved at having done with an unpleasant episode in such a way that he had not been obliged to tell lies. Besides, he was left with a vague feeling that what the nice, kind old man had said to him was not as stupid as it had seemed at first, and that there was something in it that ought to be elucidated. "Of course, not now," thought he, "but later on." He felt more than ever before that there was a kind of vagueness in his soul, a want of clearness, and that with regard to religion he was in the same position that he saw so distinctly and disliked in others, and for which he found fault with his friend Sviatsky. He spent that evening with his betrothed at the Oblonskys, and was in particularly high spirits. Explaining to Oblonsky the state of elation he was in, he said he felt as pleased as a dog that was being taught to jump through a hoop, and which, having accomplished what was demanded of it, barks and wags its tail and jumps for joy upon the tables and windowsills.
Chapter 2. On his wedding day, Lievin, according to custom, the princess and Dolly insisted on his strictly conforming to custom, did not see his bride, and dined at his hotel with three bachelors who happened to drop in. Sergei Ivanich, Katavasov, an old fellow student at the university and now a professor of natural science, whom Lievin had chanced to meet in the street and induced to come, and Chirikov, his best man, a Moscow magistrate and a bear-hunting comrade of Lievin's. The dinner was a very merry one. Sergei Ivanich was in the best of spirits and was tickled by Katavasov's originality. Katavasov, feeling that his originality was observed and appreciated, showed it off. Chirikov gaily and good-naturedly backed up everyone else.
"There now," said Katavasov with a drawl, a habit he had fallen into when lecturing. "What a talented fellow our friend Konstantin Dmitrich used to be. I am speaking of one who is not with us because he is no more. In those days he loved science. When he left the university, he had human interests. But now half his talents are bent on self-deception and the other half toward justification of that deception.
I have never come across a more decided foe of marriage than yourself," remarked Sergei Ivanich.
"No, I am no foe of marriage, but I believe in division of labor. Persons who can do nothing else must make men, and the others must help them to culture and happiness. That is how I look at it. There are hosts of aspirants who aim at mixing those two professions, but I am not one of them."
"How delighted I shall be when I hear of your falling in love," said Lievin. "Pray invite me to your wedding."
"I am in love already."
"Yes, with a mollusk.
Do you know," said Lievin, turning to his brother, "Katavasov is writing a work on nutriment, and, oh, don't confuse matters. What does it matter what I write about? The fact is, I really do love mollusks."
"But they would not prevent you loving a wife."
"They would not, but the wife would."
"Why?"
Oh, you'll soon find out. Now you like farming? Sport? Well, you just wait and see. You know, Arkhip came today to say that in Prudno there are lots of elk and two bears, said Chirikov. Well, you'll have to get them without me. There you are, said Sergei Ivanich. Goodbye to bear hunting in future. Your wife won't allow it. Levin smiled. The idea that his wife would not allow it seemed so agreeable that he was prepared to forego the pleasure of ever setting eyes on a bear again. All the same, it's a pity that those two bears will be killed without you. Do you remember that time in Hapilovka? What fine sport we had, said Chirikov. Levin did not wish to deprive him of the illusion that somewhere there could be something good without her, therefore he said nothing. This custom of taking leave of celibacy is not without its reason, said Sergei Ivanich. However happy you may be, you can't help regretting your freedom. Now confess that you feel like the bridegroom in Gogol's play who jumped out of the window, teased Chirikov.
Of course he feels so, but won't own up, said Katavasov, and burst out laughing.
Well, the window is open. Let us be off to Tver. One is a she-bear. We can go straight for the lair. Yes, let's catch the 5 o'clock train.
And leave them to do as they please here, said Chirikov, smiling.
I am ready to swear I can't find in my soul a trace of regret for my freedom, said Levin, with a smile.
Ah, but your soul is in such chaos at the present moment that you are unable to find anything there.
Wait till you settle down a bit, then you'll find it, said Katavasov.
No, I should even now have some consciousness that despite my feelings, he did not wish in Katavasov's presence to use the word love, and my happiness, I was yet sorry to lose my freedom. But quite on the contrary, it is precisely of this loss of freedom that I am glad.
Very bad. A hopeless case, said Katavasov. Well, let us drink to his recovery, or let us wish that at least 100th part of his dreams come true. Even that will be such a joy as was never seen on earth.
Soon after dinner, the visitors left to get ready for the wedding. When he was alone, Levin, thinking over the remarks of the three bachelors, once more asked himself whether there was in his soul any of that regret for his freedom that they had been speaking about. The question made him smile. Freedom? What is the good of freedom? Happiness consists only in loving and desiring, in wishing her wishes and in thinking her thoughts, which means having no freedom whatever. That is happiness.
But do I know her thoughts, wishes, or feelings?
A voice suddenly whispered. The smile faded from his face, and he pondered. And all at once a strange sensation came over him. He was possessed by fear and doubt, doubt of everything.
Supposing she does not love me? Supposing she is only marrying me just to get married? Supposing she does not herself know what she is doing? He asked himself. She might bethink herself, and only when she is already married find out that she does not and never could love me.
And strange and most evil thoughts about her came into his mind. He became jealous of Vronsky just as he had been the year before, as if it had been but yesterday that he saw her with him. He suspected that she had not told him the whole truth. Suddenly he jumped up.
No, this won't do, he said to himself, despair.